So it is November 18th, 2009. We are in Smith Hall at KU, and we're going to be talking with Ann Cobb about a childhood in small town Kansas as a Catholic. And I want to say out front, this is part of our ongoing project. We're trying to create a public record, so don't tell any deep, dark secrets. You don't want to know.
What can I say?
Yeah, as if there are any, of course. So just by way of introduction, Anne's been a friend of mine for a very long time, and she recently retired from a faculty position over at the KU Med Center. And since then has pursued what was a sideline for a long time before that, life as an artist, and has been a really active creative artist since then. And she is an anthropologist and has all kinds of credentials and all kinds of things, but we don't care about any of that today. We're going to talk about childhood in Kansas growing up Catholic. So why don't you start out and just say a little bit about your original circumstances, your family, and what they did, that kind of thing.
And you can stop me anytime if I go on too long, because I might have a tendency to do that.
Okay.
So I don't know if anybody here is from Seneca, Kansas, or Nemaha County, but that's where I grew up. And Seneca, at that time, was 87% Catholic. That's what people said. I don't know. It wasn't a real statistic, I'm sure. But we had a very large Catholic school, both elementary and high school, and fairly small public elementary and high school. My family, you know, had been Catholic forever. My father's side his parents were from Germany and German Catholics, and my mother's heritage is Czechoslovakian, and she, of course, was raised Catholic as well. And my father had a sister who was a Benedictine nun at the convent in Atchison, and a brother, Father Germain, who was a Benedictine monk at Atchison. So we were raised, you know, very, very much steeped in the tradition of Catholicism and the community as a Catholic community, because, you know, as you can imagine, in a small town, so much revolved around the school and the church, and my mother in particular was very involved. So my teachers, I went to Catholic school from first grade all the way through college. So I went to Marymount College in Salina, which no longer exists, for part of my college education. And all of our teachers, of course, were nuns at that time, and I think Catholic schools now have lots more lay teachers than was the case at that time. So in terms of context, I think you would have to say that in some sense it was a pretty insular kind of situation in terms of worldview and how one should behave and what one's religious duties were and what the rules and regulations were and so on. And beyond my aunt and uncle being religious, you know, members of religious communities, my parents, again, were also very involved with whoever the local priests and nuns were. So they would often be at our house for dinner, or the nuns, of course, not, because at that time, nuns were not allowed, the Benedictine nuns were not allowed to be in anybody's home without their mother present.
Really?
Yes. So my aunt, Sister Virginia, if we had family reunions, she could come. She could be outside on the porch, but she could not be in. And one of my earliest realizations that my father really did, you know, balk at some of these kinds of, you know, in fact, he used to tease her and say, "Saint Benedict was just crazy. That's just ridiculous." And she would just laugh, you know, they'd have this little argument about it, but she stuck to it. And, you know, she would always have to be accompanied by another nun. And I think even on the school grounds, or, you know, from going from the school to their convent house there, that they pretty much, you know, the nuns were together. I mean, the priests could sort of go singularly any place they wanted to and come in the house and all that. So You want to stop me yet?
No. Go right ahead.
Okay. So I'm from a family of three additional siblings. There were four of us, and I'm third in line from the oldest. I was asked to do this today, one of the things I thought would be important to mention is I think that when people are raised in a particular religious tradition, even within a family, I do think that you really end up with varying understandings, ideas, senses of what it means to be Catholic or to be some other religion, but certainly Catholic. The town also was very much kind of an intermarried community. So if you said, you know, my last name was Kuckelman, so everybody knew what family it belonged to. You know, if you said Uphaus, you knew who all those families were and so on. And so there was a good deal of social control just in the sense of, you know, first of all, the kinds of behaviors that were expected as a young Catholic, and also everything that you did was essentially available to be seen and discussed by everybody else. So you kind of ended up walking the narrow because of that. So what I feel my experience was with Catholicism, one of the things I think. I'm no longer a practicing Catholic and haven't been for a long time. I have two children, and I sort of raised them Catholic, but we can talk about that later. one of them certainly doesn't practice Catholicism or any other religion, and my other son sort of does, which during my generation, you were never sort of a Catholic. You either were or you were not. And things were really pretty black and white, but they were for me. I really somehow bought into that world view that there was a right and a wrong and very little gray in between. I do have to say again that my father particularly tended to be a person who questioned, so that if we came home with a story from school about, you know, sister so and so said this is the way it has to be, very often he would say, no, that's not necessarily true. And I think that was probably unusual, you know, among the families among whom I grew up. So I was saying that I do think that probably my siblings have somewhat different experiences in their living out their Catholic faith. I have two brothers who still live in Seneca, and they both are practicing Catholics, and their wives are practicing Catholics. And I really think that context has contributed to that. You know, my sister and I both left home, and, you know, she eventually went down a very different path than I did, but, you know, no longer is Catholic. So I took it all very seriously, and it was, I think, one of the things that was positive that came out of that for me is a kind of enduring sense of the sacred, because, you know, Catholicism does have a lot of, there is a lot of ritual, and, you know, when you're a small child, you can just can't wait to get the litany over with because it seems like it takes forever, you know. But as I lived through that, you know, until I was out of college, there was something about that and about the teaching that says there are things in this world that are sacred, and there are behaviors that are sacred. And that helped me when I was studying anthropology, because once I, you know, sort of broke out of what I think is a pretty closed a worldview, meaning Catholicism, once I sort of broke out of that, then it allowed me to open up to trying to understand other religious traditions, and to understand that within those traditions, there are things that, that are very sacred to those folks that may look different from what I consider sacred within my upbringing and my my religion as a child, but still have some respect for the fact that those things are very meaningful to an individual within his or her own context. Sure, you don't want to ask me a question now.
Oh, well, I mean, I will if you want me to, but yes. go ahead.
I'm going, okay, I just don't want to be wandering. Well, all right, so I think that what I could say about growing up in that situation is, first of all, I did have very supportive, very loving parents, so I totally lucked out on that. And, you know, you could bring up questions, you could discuss ideas, religious ideas and so on with my parents and you know, get their opinion about it, and no problem with that. But by the time I got to be about 14 years old, I'm going to tell this. I was telling Tamara earlier today that the difficult thing for me within Catholicism was also that at some point, though the tightness of those beliefs became really very onerous, and I sort of went a little neurotic about it. Because I don't know if you know that, for example, you all know that Catholics go to confession and they expect to receive absolution for their sins and so on. So, but what you would say in a confessional, there's the distinction between mortal sin and venial sin. So a venial sin is, you know, something trivial. You know, maybe I was, you know, cranky with my mother or something like that, but, you know, didn't do any great harm. So, you know, as a child, you would confess that kind of thing. A mortal sin, and the catechism that teaches all these things is very specific. There are definitions for all of these things. And I was trying to remember this afternoon what the definition of a mortal sin was, because I became very hung up on, is this a mortal sin or is this a venial sin? And my sense of the sense of guilt that I developed caused me to not really be able to distinguish that very clearly. But a mortal sin is something that is, I think it was a grievous offense against the law of God. It must be something that you do knowingly and willingly. So if someone forced you to do something that you didn't want to do, even if it was an evil act, but they're holding a gun to your head, there's less culpability to that. But a mortal sin can send you to hell, like instantly if you die. And so that whole thing I really got very confused about. And so then going to confession, which in my case, we went to Mass every single day, because that was part of going to Catholic grade school, is you know, the bus came to pick you up, you came and you went to Mass. And so most of the time everybody went to communion. And so when I began to be concerned about whether I had sinned or not, you would be very conspicuous if you weren't going to communion. That means you must have committed a mortal sin, you know. And so then you've got this additional concern, you know, about what other people are thinking. And so going to confession also became a very painful experience to me, because I couldn't make that distinction between those two kinds of sin. And you know, in my heart of hearts, I knew really everything was fine, but not really, you know. So, and this went on from the time I was about 14 years old until I was about 21, actually. I'm embarrassed to say, but so I thought I would tell you how it unfolded that I got out of that, so to speak. Because to give you an example of the kind of guilt and concern I had is that, you know, if Tim asked me, what time is it? And I glance at my watch and I said, you know, it's 4:15. I would look at my watch again and think, oh my God, it's 4:17. And that literally, I would worry about the fact that I had lied about, you know, or given, you know. So I'm telling you, it was pure neurosis. And none of my brothers or sisters went through this. So I'm just giving you an extreme example. So what happened is that finally I went off to college, and at some point I really realized that this was crazy. I really had to do something about this, and I didn't. And I had talked with my uncle, Father Germain, and my parents, who were just saying, you know, don't worry about these things. This is, you know, God does not expect this, and none of that worked. And for some reason, you know, I was on this Catholic campus, and there was, you know, the priest that was there was my philosophy teacher. I didn't particularly want to go to confession to him, and even though I don't think they really necessarily do know who it is or care. I'm sure they don't care who is telling them these things. So I went to downtown to whatever the church was in downtown Salina, and I just remember that the confessionals were closed confessionals with doors and, you know, all that. And there was a name on there. It was a Polish name, a priest whose last name started with W and a lot of consonants in his name. And so I went in and I basically said to him, you know, this is a problem. This is really, I can't tell the difference between these things, and I'm not going to communion because as soon as I have confessed, then I'm worried that, you know, within 10 minutes I've committed something. And he said, okay, let's do this. And I learned later, and I may be wrong, but he gave me a paradoxical injunction in psychological terms. He said, you know, he essentially used the power of his office to cause me to do what it was I was terrified of doing, in order to assure me, for me to see on my own that there was no harm. So what he said is, first of all, you know, how often have you been going to confession? You know, every week, Father. He said, all right, first, you may not go to confession any more than every 3 weeks. You may not go to confession to anyone but me. When you come into the confessional, you tell me that you're the person who has gotten all these scruples. And, you know, scrupulosity really is, I mean, it is a condition. And he said, you identify yourself that way. And meanwhile, because, again, we're still going to Mass every single day at college as well, he said, meanwhile, during those 3 weeks, you must go to communion every day. And he said, and then when you come to confession, he said, unless you can swear on a stack of Bibles to me that you have committed a mortal sin, you must go to communion. So I did that. And I think we did this for about 6 months. And then I was sent to Concordia, Kansas for, you know, for my clinical. You know, I'm taking care of patients. I'm just this mess, you know. And so this Polish priest whose name, you know, I don't remember, I told him that would be the last time I would be, you know, speaking with him. And he said, okay, when you go to Concordia, he said, you find the chaplain there and you tell him what's been going on, and then you identify yourself. You do the same thing that we've been doing. So there was this wonderful Irish priest there, whose name, again, I don't remember. But so I started doing that. So by this time, I'm about 21. And we went through this for maybe 3 months. So I probably went to confession to him 4 or 5 times. And the last time I went, I came and I said, I'm the one that's scrupulous. And he said, yeah, I know. He said, go on. And there was something about that.
The first priest had communicated with the second one?
No, he had told me that I had to identify myself to the second one. And so the second one and I did this for about an additional period of time. And he got really tired of it. And that was it. And I was done with that. And, you know, and something about the way they handled it. And, you know, I have no idea why those particular priests had those particular skills, you know, because I'm kind of surprised looking back on it that first Polish priest, as I identified, really kind of knew how to handle that. Maybe they were... So, you know, it would be easy for me to say, well, you know, Catholicism really made me nuts, but you know, it was a little of the sort of regulations and rules and so on was a part of that, but the rest of it just had to do with my particular personality and, you know, the fact that I wanted to do good. And so there were some really positive things, and in my case, some things that were very much a challenge in sort of living through that particular faith. I did go off as a volunteer to Brazil on a Catholic program called Papal Volunteers for Latin America, and lived in Brazil for a year. And that was when I began to really come into contact with it was mostly Catholics again, but lots of the different cultural traditions that helped me to, you know, continue to mature. I think that we do, you know, hopefully we do mature in our faith throughout our lifetime. I think that that we learn different ways to handle the challenges and to, so on. So,
you tell us a little more about just what Catholic daily life was like. I don't know, did you wear uniforms to school?
Yeah. Okay.
Anything along that line?
Sure. Yeah, no, we did not wear uniforms to school. I mean, but the nuns were still in habits at the time. And, you know, there are tons of jokes about, you know, nuns and how many they are and so on. I loved the nuns. We were, you know, and I think, you know, I found them very warm. They had these, you know, these black woolen outfits with a rosary on the side, and you could hear them clicking down the hall. And, you know, for the most part, they were very kind. And I'm sure that some of that was because my mother was very involved with them, and, you know, my family was very good to them and that kind of thing. But so the kids that went to the Catholic schools, though, there was nothing like uniforms. But the day would be, you know, you get up, and if you're going to be going to communion that morning, my mother would fix us all egg sandwiches, all four of us, egg sandwiches to take, and you would go get off the bus, go immediately to, I don't remember if we went to the school room and then went to the church, but we would go as a group, so you sat with your first grade, your second grade, third grade, or whatever, and then when Mass was over and you went to the classroom, classes would begin, but you would be allowed to eat your, you know, to have your breakfast. And, you know, certainly every single class that was taught was kind of imbued with the worldview of Catholicism, and particularly, I suppose, history, and you know, certainly no mention of the Inquisition in my education until later. And there would be courses in religion all the way through. You know, when you're in grade school, it's catechism. So you would have catechism classes every single day. And the catechisms were like orange, blue, red, purple, or something. And you know, like first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. So it's all the same material, but, you know, made with a little more sophisticated language. And then when you got into high school, they had courses in apologetics, you know, how to defend the faith. And I remember going to parties and, you know, arguing with people about, you know, adamantly about, you know, giving a Catholic stance on things. Bible history was, you know, more in grade school. But those were mostly the lives. Well, they were stories taken from the Bible, but there was a lot of information about lives of the saints and so on. We did, you know, like a lot of, in a lot of faiths, there's a midweek kind of, you know, church gathering or whatever, but ours was just Sunday. And when I was really small, you know, it was, all of this was really very traditional, and some of you may know that in the 60s there was what was called the Second Vatican Council, and that was when Pope John the 23rd, I hope that's right, mm-hmm. Yeah, Pope John the 23rd, who was put in as an interim pope, and everybody thought that he was like 80-something. They thought he was going to die. Well, he did die, I think, within 3 years. But he absolutely changed the practice of Catholicism in a very short time. And by calling this council, And that was the point at which the Mass was changed from Latin to a vernacular. So, you know, when I was in Brazil, people were doing the Mass in Portuguese instead of Latin. And, of course, in Seneca, Kansas, we were doing it in English. And, you know, before that, almost all of the Mass was sung in Latin. And you know, if you had a funeral, it was all sung in Latin. And that was the point at which nuns were given the freedom as congregations to decide whether they wanted to continue to wear the religious habit or if they wanted to wear, you know, street dress. And it was also a time, so that would have been about 1962, 63, and by 1969, I mean, one of the things that happened is a lot of religious left their, you know, left their, the religious life. You know, it's kind of you open the door and, you know, people then realize they have choices that they didn't really have before. So a lot of people who were priests actually left and married. A lot of nuns left and many of them married, sometimes each other. So throughout my life, I've also been, like in my work life at the medical center, one of the other faculty members was a religious. She was a nun, Sister Ann Shorfide, and that, you know, by the time I was teaching there, you know, she would just introduce herself as Ann Shorfide, and, you know, she didn't, you know, if anybody wanted to know if she was a nun, that was okay, but she didn't make any deal about it, and she was wearing lay clothing and so on. So let's see, a day. So basically Sundays were a big thing, but there were also, you know, during Lent, the Lenten season was very important, the 40 days of Lent. And so all adults and children fasted in some way or another. Again, when I was really a small child, everybody fasted every Friday from meat. Nobody had meat on Fridays. After the Vatican Council, you could have meat on Fridays. And the other thing is, if you were going to, that was the reason, the other reason that, you know, your parents sent breakfast with you to class was because if you went to communion, you had to actually fast from any food or water from midnight until after the Vatican Council. And then after the Vatican Council, you could drink water before you took communion, but I don't think you could eat. But now I don't think it makes any difference at all. And I mean, and that was again an issue of what is sacred, and that is, you know, that if you believe, as the Church taught, that you literally are taking the body and blood of Christ into your body by receiving the communion host, then, you know, you want your body to be essentially pure and receptive in some way. That food was kind of thought to, you know, secularize it, I guess. So let's see, and then then there would also be First Friday was an important religious tradition as well, and that was a lot of people actually went to Mass on First Friday. You didn't have to, but I think a lot of people would go on the first Friday of the month. There kind of was extra fasting, and then we would do the Stations of the Cross, which are the 12 Stations of the Cross, which are the 12 steps along the way toward Calvary. What?
14.
No, I think ours were 12. 14? Yeah. Okay.
It's always 14.
I bow to the scholar.
They
have
two of them a little higher.
Yeah. Well, let me see. Yeah, I can't. Obviously, I haven't done the Stations of the Cross for 40 years. So, but that was so. There were lots of, you know, what might be considered sort of minor rituals. But you know, in some ways, they really were very comforting, and it very much, I think, gives a child an identity, you know, as belonging here, you know, with this family, with this religious tradition, and so on. When it's sort of very tightly controlled like that, it also makes it very difficult to deviate from that eventually.
That was probably your 12-step group.
You may be right. So let's see. And I suppose that the tradition that I probably enjoyed the most, even up into my 30s, was Holy Saturday and Easter Sunday, because there's a and Palm Sunday, you have the procession and you had you come home with palms, and my mother always, the palms that you get are just long and thin like this, but sometimes the nuns would weave them into certain shapes and everything, and we always had religious pictures, well, one or two in our house, and my mother would have, we put the palm behind that, and then if there was a terrible storm, as one of the things you would do was you would light the palm, and you would, as a prayer of protection.
Burn it?
Yeah. You would burn the palm. Mm-hmm. Huh. And you didn't necessarily burn the whole thing in case there was another storm. Wow. But those would be carried into the procession, would come out of the church, go around the block, and then come back in. And in other countries, of course, they're much more elaborate, and they would carry statues and all that kind of thing. But then there was a blessing of the Easter candle, which is this gigantic, probably 5 foot long, this big candle. That I think burns through, kind of throughout the year or something. And the Litany of the Saints, which, as I said, as a child, I thought was never ending, really, it's like a chant. And so it became something that I found very beautiful as a young adult. And I think that was part of that Holy Saturday ritual. And also, of course, as kids, you didn't have to wait till Easter Sunday to dive into all the candy that you'd been fasting from. You could actually start on Holy Saturday. But that was the thing that children often did, was they would give up candy, but then you'd put it in a box or something all during the 40 days, and we were always very good about not touching it. And then it was just like Halloween is now. You just gorge on the candy that day. So.
Okay, another childhood thing. I presume you had First Communion at some point.
Oh, yes.
All that like?
I think I was very delighted with that as a child.
How old were you?
You're seven when you take First Communion. Then, yeah.
Okay.
You were then. I don't know what you were.
In that church.
Yeah. Well, in all Catholic churches at that time.
In that diocese.
I think everywhere.
Bishops have their own rules.
Yeah. Okay. Are you sure in 1959 that they
didn't? No, it might have been different then. That was pre-council. So.
Yeah, right. Well, anyway, you see, I think you're making a really important point, because it's what I remember is what I thought it was like then, in terms of,
Don't you think that's what we all do? We grow up and we think our experience is everyone's. That's typical.
Well, and part of what the Catholic Church taught at the time that I was growing up is that the church is universal. That anywhere in the world, if you go to a Catholic Mass, it's the same. Well, it kind of was, because it was all in Latin. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it kind of... But anyways, but then I think you extrapolate that to other situations. So, okay, what were we talking about?
No, First Communion.
First Communion, okay, yes.
At seven.
At seven, yeah. Well...
Which is when you're supposed to be old enough to understand what's going on, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You are thought to be of the age of reason, is that how it was put to us. And so you, at that point, would know what a sin was and was not. So, the little white dresses, everybody had, the little girls had little white dresses, and the boys, I don't know, but I don't have any pictures of the boys, but, they all had little suits of some sort. And... my cousin Virginia was like 5 days difference in age from me, and the only picture that I have a picture of myself in my First Communion dress, and so we wore little veils, and I think everybody wore the same kind of veil, and it was interesting because there was kind of a ruffle, and my mother starched mine so it came like this, and then my cousin's was left soft by her mother, and we looked really different. And I think you could wear any kind of little dress. What I remember the most, to tell you the truth, was that we wore long white stockings, hose, with garters. And I was terrified that my stockings were going to fall down. But other than that, it really was considered, you know, an incredibly important and wonderful event. And it was very much celebrated. I don't remember what, you know, I suspect that probably my mother had all the relatives come to the house afterwards. I don't remember it, but I do remember, again, that, you know, that had to have been one of the most sort of sacred events, and you were prepared for that, you know, by the family, but also, so you were second grade by the time you were seven, mm-hmm. So in first grade, and I actually got to be one of the, you know, one of the ways that they kind of enhanced things was that about four or five first grade girls got to be like, almost like little bridesmaids or something. I can't remember what we were called. And so I was one of those four when I was six. And I think we led the procession of the communicants in. And, you know, and we had colorful long dresses and great big bows, you know. And so, you know, there was a kind of staging of these things. And then, so there was, yeah, all the seven sacraments, and there are seven, there, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So First Communion was one. And Confirmation, of course, was the other. And Confirmation was important, but I don't remember it as being having quite the same emphasis. You did take an additional name when you were confirmed. I don't know if they do that in other churches or not. And virtually every girl took the name of Mary, I think, as their confirmation name.
And that's older, right?
That's, yeah, I think that was when you were about 12, maybe something like that. let's see. Well, and of course, marriage as one of the sacraments and one of the really important rituals when I was in my teens, you know, when I was a child and in my teens and so on, you simply did not marry outside the faith, so to speak. You know, you were expected to marry a Catholic. And yet there were people in my parents' generation, a few, who actually were in what was called a mixed marriage. But for the person who was not Catholic, there was a process which required that person to promise to raise the children Catholic. And I don't know if you had to sign anything or not, but, and then when I got married, I married someone who was not Catholic, and by that time, you know, things had loosened up a lot, but he still had to go through,
RICA. Rites of Initiation Catholic, RICA.
Okay, that's not a term I'm familiar with, but it was, you're right. I mean, it was something.
I'll tell you what it is in a second.
Okay. Anyway, basically, we had to meet with the priest several times, and you know, and he did have to make that promise that the children would be raised Catholic, but I remember going to that, and by that time I had loosened up quite a bit myself, and I would watch him talk with priests, and I think they're having a theological. They're just talking. You know, this is an intellectual discussion. This isn't anything about instructing him at all. You know, but then he probably wouldn't have stood for that anyway. So, did you think of it?
Well, A's for adults, C's for Catholic, I's for initiation, and R's for rites, I believe. Yeah. That'd be R. Yeah. R. I know. R and S, something like that. Just the adults can get into be accepted, get confirmed, and then you just go in like night classes. You take one a week for 12 weeks.
That's about right, yeah.
And then you just state your intention, and then the next day or the next Sunday you will go in front of the church. And mm-hmm. It's kind of like playing high, low, and poker. Yes or no, or both ways.
Yeah. Well, so.
So the process of leaving, so to speak, mm-hmm. was pretty long and drawn out. It sounds like over quite a bit of time you got looser on it. And mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you said when you had children, You still raised them Catholic to some degree. Let's say more about that.
Okay. Let me tell you what there was a particular moment at which I really felt, I can't believe this anymore. And that was right before I went off to Brazil. I went to Mass, and I was in Chicago at the Chicago Maternity Center delivering babies in the home. And I walked down the street to go to Mass, and at the moment that the priest raised the host, you are required to believe that that host is the body and blood of Christ. And there was just this overwhelming feeling that, I simply can't believe that anymore. And so that was kind of the first break. And then other things happened along the way. Second half of your question?
Well, raising the children.
Oh, raising the children, yeah. So then, of course, I married somebody that wasn't Catholic. Both of the boys were baptized, and then it was a different experience for each one. There's almost 4 years difference in their age. So we were going, of course, to to the university, St. Lawrence Center, and it wasn't Father Vince, but whoever the priest was, I can't remember. I don't think we had any problem. We just called him and said, we want to get Matthew baptized, and so my family came, and we had Godfather and Godmother and so on, and again, that used to be something that was very, if you agreed to be the Godfather or Godmother and the parents failed to raise the child Catholic, you were supposed to take that responsibility on. I never knew an instant when anybody did that, but that's really what the symbolic meaning of that was in my, in my experience. So anyway, we got Matthew baptized, and that was fine, and Daniel came along, and we called, there was a priest named Father Rossiter, I think, at that time, and he asked a few questions. He said, do you intend to raise this baby Catholic? And by that time, I wasn't sure that I could say I was going to. And so I said, I don't know. I don't know that I am. And he said, then why would I baptize him? I said, I want you to. And, wow. And he reluctantly did baptize him. But he was, and I understood his position. And let's see. And so I took the children to church with me, and I went to church at St. Lawrence Center until, I don't know, Daniel's about 3. Matt must have been about 9 years old, and at that point I just thought, I can't do this anymore. And so I started going to Unity with one of my neighbors for a while, and then my son Matt, the older of the two, came to me when he was 12, and of course he had all these Catholic cousins, that he knew, although we didn't see them often, but he had Catholic friends, here in Lawrence. And he came to me, and his face was just red, and he said, Mom, I want to take communion. And I said, well, you can't just do that, and we hadn't been going to church for about 3 or 4 years. And he said, I know. And I said, you'd have to take instructions. And, this is a kid that, doesn't want to listen to anybody. And he said, I know. I said, you'll do that? And he said, yes. I said, well, okay. So I called up Father Vince, and I asked him if, I told him the situation, and I asked if he would do the instruction, because that's who I knew. And he said, well, yeah, he would do that. So we go to the parish house, and we're sitting out waiting for Father Vince to open the door, and I said, now, Matt, I'll let you go in by yourself. And he said, no, and I said, you want me to go in there too? Which surprised me, just because he was a really independent kid. And he said, yes. And I said, okay. So I went in, and I sat in there every single time, for the 12 lessons, however long it took for him to get the instructions so he could take communion. And And again, a really verbal kid. He never said a word. He listened to every word that Father Vince said. You know, and we had a little celebration when he made his first communion, and Father Vince came and all of that. And then at that point, I thought, okay, now I've got to be taking this kid to church, so I have to resolve some things. So I went and made an appointment with Father Vince, and that day in the newspaper, you know, the Pope was quoted. I hope I'm not saying too much. The Pope was quoted, you know, about he was, you know, against divorce, against abortion, against homosexuality, against whatever, you know. And I don't. That's a crass way to put it. That isn't exactly how it was, but that's essentially what it was. So I took the article with me, and when I sat down with Father Vince, I said, "These are all the reasons that I have problems with being Catholic." And he looked at it and he said, "Well, you know," so we talked for quite a while, and I just said, "You know, this is pretty personal, but you know, I decided that two children was enough for me, and I had a tubal ligation after my second child, and that was another aspect of that," and I said that to Father Vincent. He said, "Well, you know, if you were making that decision again, you might make it differently." I said, "No, I would not. Absolutely, that's one of the best decisions I've ever made." And so we did, and he was very sweet, and he just said, "Well, you know, Anne, I think you're kind of a purist, but then so am I. So, you know, bring Matt to church, but, you know, just stay." You know, he just left it hanging like that, and I thought, that's good. So I then took Matt to church every Sunday, and I did not participate in the sacraments, because for me, you know, and I know by that time a lot of people would have thought it was probably okay for, you know, to go ahead and participate in the sacraments, but that just really wasn't, I guess, it didn't make any difference to me, I guess, particularly, that I couldn't do that. And, you know, it was just clear cut for me that way, so I didn't. And so Matt went to church for 4 years. I took him every Sunday, and I was telling Tamara that it was time for him to do confirmation lessons, and he took all the confirmation lessons, but it was harder and harder to get him up for Mass. So when he got confirmed, I said, "You're 16. I'm not getting you up every Sunday. You get up yourself, and you can drive yourself to church. If you want me to go along, I'll go, but I'm not taking responsibility." And that was the last time he went, as far as I know. Yeah, but there was no, I mean, it was fine with me. I think it was what he needed and what he wanted to do at the time, and I think he learned a lot. And actually, he married a Catholic young woman, and they baptized their first child. I don't know whether the second one is going to, I don't know how they're living that out, and that's not the issue here. But because I really, the other thing that I think about, you know, everything that I'm telling you is like from what, 1940 something to, you know, to the present, and so there are real generational differences now, I think, in terms of not only what young people believe, but, you know, even what they've been taught, and so, and people live out their faith in a whole variety of ways, and I'm very comfortable with most of that, certainly for, you know, what's happened in my family. So
can you say a little bit more about your own spiritual progression after that? You mentioned that it sounds like it started with going to Unity.
Yeah, it did.
And then what happened after that?
Well, it started when I started going to Unity, it was the relief there was that Unity is so non-dogmatic. So it was the exact opposite of Catholicism. And it was, you know, in my view, it was a very sort of positive belief system, but a very open belief system. And, you know, I also was going in part because my friend had been going, and, you know, she was taking me. And so I did that for those were the years maybe between the time that I stopped taking the kids to Catholic Church and before Matt decided he wanted to, you know, have communion and so on. So that was a positive experience for me. And then after that, well, I can't remember exactly the progression, but I just have always done a lot of spiritual reading. I did get very involved in process work, which is sort of Jungian psychology, but it's transpersonal psychology, which holds essentially that we are spirit, you know, that psychologically even we are spirit. So, you know, there was a lot of doing things with dreams and so on. And I wouldn't call it a religious system, but certainly for me it was a spiritual experience to be involved in some really intensive workshops where, you know, people were often dealing with issues of spirituality. And from that, I can't remember if the next thing was deciding to study Buddhism. And so I've been kind of, I certainly wouldn't call myself a Buddhist, but I've been
to call yourself a Buddhist means you're not a Buddhist.
Yes, I know. That's exactly right. So I think that in terms of where I am now is that there's just this wonderful range of beliefs that people have, and I think I believe a little bit of any of them, of all of them, and I don't believe a whole lot of any of them. So, I think that the need for ritual or the need for attachment to institutional religion is not there for me now. And I'm not seeking that in any way.
So even though in childhood that seemed like that was an important part of it, that's simply something that you've moved away from.
Right. Yeah, and as a child, of course, I didn't really have a choice because, you know, it was all
right.
Decided for me. Right. So, and it feels much more it feels much more comfortable to me to be where I am in terms of belief now, and hopefully more open to other people's experience of whatever their spiritual path is. And
were your parents fairly much okay with things as you were obviously dropping out? I don't imagine you went and told them that I'm not going to have anything more to do with this anymore, but
yeah.
It must have been obvious too.
Well, it does become obvious when you go home and everybody gets up to go to mass, and you're just like, I think I'll just sleep in this morning. Yeah. I mean, you don't exactly do that, but I mean, I'm sure for a while I just went ahead and went to mass when I was there because I didn't want to cause any problems. But one of my cousins confronted me, and this might be interesting to you in terms of this class, because somehow, in a small town, believe me, there's a telegraph and everybody knows, even when you're living in Lawrence, Kansas, somehow my cousin had heard that I was going to Unity, but she confused it with...
Unitarian?
No, with the Moonies. What is their
Unification
Church? Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty different.
And she came over to see me, and we were driving somewhere, and she said, "Well, and I'm just going to tell you that I'm really upset about the fact that you've become a Mooney." And she said, "Well, that's what I heard. Everybody says in Central that you're a Mooney." And I thought, "Oh my God." So I just said, no. I mean, I don't even remember what I said, except I did set her straight that that was not the situation, and so on. And then, shortly after that, I don't remember how it happened, but I was my mother got Alzheimer's fairly, during this period that I'm describing now. So she was, and she was really very devout. And so, but I was talking to my father on the phone, and apparently he had heard this, and he never said anything to me, but somehow it came up in our conversation. And maybe I called him and told him that I was concerned because I had heard that was what people at Seneca thought. And he just said to me, "Well, do you ever go to the Catholic Church anymore?" And I said, "No, I don't, Dad." And he said, "What do you think your mother would think of that?" And it was just like... but it was also very loving and very. And he never said another word about it to me, and I'm sure he really meant that my mother, that it would be hurtful to her, And I think I just said, well, you know, I don't know, Dad. And we dropped it, and that was, and my, you know, I don't, my brothers obviously know that I don't go to church, and they do, and only recently that it is, there have been some little intimations of, you know, maybe wanting to discuss that some, but I'm pretty, I mean, if they want to ask me anything, I would be fine with that, but I also want to have a sensitivity to what their beliefs are, so I'm not at all interested in challenging what they believe or anything like that. So we, you know, we're sort of living in peaceful coexistence as far as, they seem to like me, I think, so I like them.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's worked pretty well.
Well, anything else you can think of you'd like to say? Been going for almost an hour.
Yeah. there was something I thought of when I was telling you that Mooney story, but I can't. Well, it must not have been anything important. Yeah. I think that's plenty.
Okay, so, I think that's enough.
You probably think that's plenty, too.
That's great strategy.
What?
The unification people, or the unity people, should say Mooney. Or then think Mooney, and then when they find out it's Uni for one of us, then it won't be near as bad if we just started out with unification or
well, you
unity church.
You remember how there was so much coverage of that, you know, what, 20 or 15 years ago or something, and I don't hear anything about that. What is happening with the unification church?
No.
Do you have any idea?
They're still going.
Are they?
Moon is still alive. He's quite elderly
now. Is he really?
I think he's pretty close to 90. And they're just this week, they're having a big showdown family issues. You know, they have that newspaper that's influential in Washington, the Washington Times, that Mooney owned. Uh-huh. And there's some battles going on over control of that and within the Moon family to some degree. I haven't followed it closely.
I believe they named who's going to take over the church after he died.
Well, he's one of his sons is heir apparent. I think. You may know more about this.
It was in a paper. I read it online, so I'm not sure which one.
So their center now is in Washington, D.C.? Is that what you said?
Well, I think Moon still lives in New York State, as far as I know.
Okay.
But they have that newspaper, which is their biggest public activity.
Okay. And did they still have the mass marriages?
Oh, yeah.
Because that was what really hit the press a lot, were the mass marriages,
yeah.
If I recall.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming in.
You're
welcome. This is great.